Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, folks. My name is Michael Weinberg, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm the president of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute, and I'm pleased to be your moderator for tonight's program. Joining us is Raihan Salam, one of this generation's leading public intellectuals. He's executive editor of the National Review, as well as a contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Affairs. He's joining us today to talk about his new book, Melting Pot or Civil War, The Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. It's an excellent, we went back and forth a little bit today on the title, but I want to let you all know it's an excellent, thought-provoking, deeply researched book that everyone here should purchase and read. This is perhaps especially true if you, like I do, prefer a higher level of immigration at all skill levels. Raihan's book makes a passionate and a compelling case that more modest levels of primarily higher skill immigration will be substantially better for all Americans, and especially recent immigrants. It is this case he'll be laying out in our conversation over the course of the next hour. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Raihan Salam to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, Micah. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you. I mean, I've got to say, given how many dizzyingly amazing, immersive entertainment options you have at your disposal, you've decided to come here, listen to two very earnest men talk about a really wonky and challenging subject. So I salute you. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, and I want to keep it wonky.
I feel like this crowd's going to be.
Can we do
that.
It?
I feel like we're going to make that work.
Because it is so easy, I think, to get into the polarized and essentially meaningless set of arguments we're having about immigration in the country today. But what I found so refreshing about your book was how it didn't map easily onto anything I'm hearing on immigration right now. And so I'd like to, in the first series of questions, really give you an opportunity to lay out some of the key theses of your book, which is described as a case against open borders. So I thought I'd actually ask you to start by articulating the case for open borders, the case of the sort of, you call them bullet biters.
Yes.
And how your proposals are a little bit in reaction to that.
One of the reasons this book is very, very strange, as you might find if you choose to buy it, is because I myself have inhabited a number of different positions on this issue. I've been pretty torn about this issue, partly because of certain quirks of my biography, the fact that I my parents are immigrants, as is implied in the title, and I have always lived in immigrant-rich communities. I have deep sympathy for immigrants. I identify with immigrants and all sorts of ways. And I guess I have always been fascinated by what I'll call radical arguments. And when I say radical, I don't mean that derisively. I mean radical arguments, arguments that go to the root, arguments that really go all the way. Let's think hard about the implications of what it is we kind of think by instinct and what have you. So the case for open borders, the heart of it is a moral argument, right? The heart of it is this belief that we do not have the right to deny people the opportunity to share in our prosperity. That's not really our doing, but it's the doing of the institutions we've built, that we've inherited over a really long period of time. And also, there are other components to that case, too. So I really do think that that moral piece of it is really, really central. Because frankly, if that moral piece of it is right, you can make all kinds of other practical arguments about whether or not it's wise, what effect is it likely to have on earnings and what have you, what effect is it likely to have on the shape, the productivity of the economy and much else. But really, that moral piece is enormously important. And I'd argue that it's actually become more important in the politics of immigration as the landscape has changed, as offshoring has seen to it that low-wage employers, they really don't have the same appetite for low-skill immigration that they might have had in earlier eras. And so now, in our public discourse, it's become more of a moral, and some might say moralistic, kind of argument. But when you're looking at the economic component, you know, the insight is very simple. The idea is that people are creative. People are innovators. People are problem solvers. People are consumers. And when you have more people, that is in itself a very good thing that creates more opportunities, that creates this kind of flywheel of prosperity and progress. Now, there are some other elements to it as well. So one argument is, if you're thinking about global inequality, if you think that that's what really matters, because you really need to think about people as human beings rather than as citizens of any given individual state, if you think in those terms, then policies that reduce global inequality ought to take precedence over policies that, you know, might exacerbate domestic inequality, because that's what ought to come first. And there are lots of implications of that idea, but I think that that's also a pretty central idea of some of the sophisticated folks who advocate for open borders. Now, as you'll see, I do not embrace this case. I reject it. But I do think it's really, really important in our debates to try to think hard about the position we disagree with and try to characterize it as fairly as we can. There are, of course, other nuances to it, but that's what I see as the kind of heart of the argument.
Yeah, and in some ways you're sort of yanking the moral high ground away from sort of the pro-immigration crowd in the United States, because you point out, actually, they're drawing lines as well. Most of the folks, Democrats included, are not making the case for open borders. They're saying, well, we'll have DACA and, you know, certain people will qualify and certain people won't qualify. So you're maybe drawing the line at a different place, but most folks aren't making that sort of intensely moral argument that to combat global inequality, we should bring people here for the purpose of bettering their lives.
I think of it a bit differently. I think you're really onto something. I think that's a very astute reading. But I guess as I see it, a lot of the argument right now, I often don't see it quite as an argument about immigration and future flows. It really feels much more like an argument about the American character. How do we think about the legacy of past immigration, and how does our rhetoric about future immigration reflect how we think about the legacies of the past? And we live in obviously a very charged, polarized political climate, and it's almost as though you have clashing narratives about what it means to be an American, and the politics of immigration policy wind up being secondary to those considerations. What am I saying? What am I saying symbolically by taking this or that position? But yes, when you're looking at the actual policies we're talking about, it's really fascinating. When people defend the immigration status quo, they are defending a system that is not, in fact, open. Rather, it is open to the relatives of some folks who are already citizens or lawful permanent residents. You know, there are a lot of subtleties to this. And oftentimes, I would argue there's a dimension of interest group politics to it as well. But what you do, at least what I often see, is that people use very expansive moral language to talk about policies that in practice are actually really quite limited in a way. And I think that that disjuncture actually engenders a lot of resentment, a lot of confusion, and actually winds up being pretty pernicious.
Yeah. So let's put the expansiveness aside and maybe jump immediately into your own experience as the son of immigrants. You sort of make the case in this book that the folks that are in favor of immigration in the United States like to emphasize the feel-good stories. Well, you and your family really are a feel-good story. So tell us a little bit about the nature of that story.
Well, I'll start by saying that I always, you know, and that was a funny, challenging thing about writing this book. I always feel pretty uncomfortable and wary when it comes to talking about my own story, but I did feel as though with this book, I felt obligated to. I felt that it was important. And one reason I feel, you know, kind of a little conflicted about it is simply because, look, I mean, every single individual story is kind of richly complicated. You scratch beneath the surface of it, you find lots of contradictions. You find, you know, kind of when I think about my own family story, it's almost like you're peeling back layer after layer, and you always learn new things about it. My understanding of my parents' story is different now than it was 5 years ago, than it was 10 years ago. It's always being revised in a way. But, you know, basically, I think of my parents as pretty classic. They are people who, you know, my father was less conflicted, my mother was more conflicted about the idea of leaving behind everything they knew, leaving behind their family. One thing that they did have, however, and this is a kind of really uncomfortable thing to talk about, is that they had what some scholars call class-specific resources. And what I mean by that is this. They came from a society in South Asia, in Bangladesh, a society that was already a pretty stratified society, in which you had a kind of narrow group of people who were lucky enough to have formal education, who were lucky enough to have higher education, and who were lucky enough to be steeped in the English language as well as in their native language. And what that meant is that as folks who had those class-specific resources, which, by the way, didn't make them, first of all, I love my parents, but it didn't make them great people or morally superior to anyone who did not have those resources. But what it meant is that they had certain skills that are involved in being someone who's able to navigate a social hierarchy, right? So when they came to another country, you know, it's the case that they didn't necessarily have a ton of assets. They didn't have a ton of dollars. What they did have, however, was a lot of cultural capital. What they did have was the ability to navigate this new and familiar environment because of skills they brought with them from their native country. And when you look at a lot of our immigration stories right now, what I often feel is though we talk about immigration as though it is an undifferentiated phenomenon. When in fact, when you're talking about divided, stratified societies, it actually makes a very big difference what your starting point was, what the resources were, the class-specific resources were that you were bringing with you to the United States. So just to put it really, really bluntly, you know, my parents, I could tell you all kinds of sob stories. You know, they kind of, you know, encountered lots of challenges. They both worked really, really long hours the whole time I was growing up. But, you know, ultimately, they did have this great gift, which was this kind of confidence, this cultural and social capital that really did help them navigate American life. And there are many other immigrants who are equally decent, hardworking, impressive people who did not necessarily have those resources at their disposal. And in my view, when you think about it in those stratified terms, what winds up happening is that folks who don't have those resources, you know, they subjectively improve their economic position. Otherwise, they would not have moved from one country to another. They would not have made that big leap. But on the other hand, they often find themselves really stuck on the bottom rungs of American society. And that, you know, that's one thing if you're the person who chose to make that leap to better your life in that way. But when you look to the second generation, right, that's where things can get more complicated.
Yeah, so in a lot of ways, this is the sort of moral heart of your story, is that you're saying that for these second-generation immigrants, their experience is not necessarily going to be positive. And in fact, that allowing substantially more immigration of people without these, as you delicately put it, class-specific resources, is not actually especially good for the second generation of lower-skilled immigrants that have come to the country.
So this is a really thorny question, and as you guys can probably tell, you know, I'm not from San Francisco, I'm from Brooklyn, New York, but I'm from an environment in which I encounter a lot of really intense skepticism of this sort of argument. So it's really important to me to try to talk about this really, really carefully.
There hasn't been any booing yet.
But
we might get there.
What I really want to drive home, so one piece of the discourse you hear a lot about is this idea of merit-based immigration. And one reason why I'm uncomfortable with that language is that I think that all kinds of people have merit. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily, you know, just because you have a PhD does not necessarily mean you have more merit than someone who has an eighth grade education. But I guess when I think about the second generation landscape, it's a little bit broader. What I'm concerned about is whether or not we're going to have unifying narratives and whether or not we are going to do the things necessary to ensure that kids growing up in poor families have the resources that they need to flourish and thrive. And when I think about it in those terms, that's how I think about future flows. That's how I think about future immigration. Because basically, I believe that over the last 30 plus years, we have absorbed a decent number of folks, wonderful people, who have limited skills. And basically, we have not actually thought very hard about what it's going to mean to really knit them, and more importantly, to my mind, their children into the mainstream of our society to ensure that they're part of our leadership class, okay? And I believe that that's going to be a pretty resource-intensive endeavor. So when you think about that, then when you think about the future, you think, well, wait a second. Given that we are, you know, we have all kinds of uncertainties around automation, around offshoring, which is going to look more and more like the offshoring of services, virtual immigration and what have you. You have all of these uncertainties. Given that, I believe that if you're going to make the case that we need to make big investments in our young, you also have to say, okay, but then in terms of future flows, we are going to take a more humble approach. People say that the immigration debate is about being open or closed. My own view is that, and forgive me if this sounds polemical, but is that it's about whether you are being hubristic or being humble. Being humble in the face of all of the uncertainties, the rancorous politics, the stratification along lines of class and also along lines of color that already exist in our society. And then thinking really hard about that and what it's going to take to try to knit a very divided society back together. So I think about the immigration thing really in this larger context of what it's going to take to heal some of our divides.
Sure, absolutely. And this gets into the concept of the melting pot versus civil war. But here in a place like the Bay Area, the concept of a melting pot has gotten a very bad rap because the idea is that it was a melting pot, but only for certain people. Only certain folks were able to move into the higher strata of society. How do we, I mean, putting aside people's reactions to that term, how do we do it right? How do we integrate in the right way?
This is a very fraught subject.
I feel like you're starting each of these
I'm saying it out of a really genuine place.
Yeah.
I'm saying it from a place of, you know, I grew up in immigrant communities. I grew up in communities of color. You know, this is the sea that I swam in. And I'm keenly aware that, you know, the idea of the melting pot to a lot of people sounds like an idea of conformity, an idea of surrendering everything that makes you distinctive, the things that you feel has enriched your life. So I understand that that's this kind of notion about what the melting pot is. I have a different view of it. And I guess my view is that to have a kind of common culture, it's a dynamic. It's something that can change over time, that can be enriched by new traditions, by new ideas. This idea of creating new hybrid ethnicities, you know, new identities. I think that that's something that is always happening, and that's something that can really be an enormously positive and productive and constructive development. But I also think that it's a really important thing to undergird ideas of solidarity. The idea that, you know, when you think about a nation state, when you think about membership, when you think about citizenship, is it merely transactional? Or is it something that's more than that? When you're telling people, hey, look, we expect you to make certain sacrifices to be part of this larger social compact, I do believe that the idea of, not that we all come from common origins, but the idea that our posterity, that our children, our grandchildren will be linked together, tied together in this very deep way, will be dependent on one another in a very deep way. That's kind of how I think about it. Now, you mentioned very astutely, when you look at the history of the melting pot, it's a thorny history because this is something that to many people seemed to be something that excluded people who were not of European origin, let's say. And I guess when I think about multiculturalism and the origins of the multicultural ethic, I often think of it as a product of a failure. And that's the failure, the sense that, okay, we have failed to really fully include. We're not willing to make the sacrifices it will take to fully include some of the populations that have historically been marginalized and excluded. And so because of that, we'll move away from the melting pot ideal and we'll try to be positive about the fact that we're moving away from it. When in fact, you know, to my mind, we should not have accepted that failure. We should have said, well, no, we're actually going to endeavor to kind of break down those barriers, to really create this kind of common culture and the kind of scaffolding that common culture will require. So when I think about the future, I just really think that that melting pot ethic is enormously important to making America flourish in a time of this kind of uncertainty that I referenced before.
And so briefly, that's the positive scenario. What is the nightmare scenario? What are you worried about in terms of if we continue on the path that we're on currently?
I will talk about it in California-specific terms. California is a state that is very stratified, as you all know. It's a state where if you look at the supplemental poverty measure, it is a state with the highest poverty rate. And you know that translates into folks who feel as though they cannot find decent housing, folks who live in illegal underground housing because they can't find those opportunities, folks who feel as though they cannot accumulate assets, who feel as though their children are stuck. And you also have really the most spectacular wealth in the Western world. You have this kind of cheek by jowl in California. And you know, in lots of ways, it kind of works, right? It kind of feels like, hey, this is a very kind of vital, dynamic place. You do have that inequality, but you also have an enormous amount of dynamism and creativity that comes from that. But I guess when I look to the future, when I look, 15, 20 years hence, here's what I see. I see an upper strata of California society that looks markedly different from, let's say, the bottom 30 or 40% of the population. And when I'm looking at that bottom chunk of the population, I think of a lot of folks who will feel unjustly excluded and marginalized. I will see people who are not themselves immigrants who feel as though, hey, I'm the one who made this leap, I made this change. I see second-generation people. My father, for example, he's someone who worked as a civil servant, and he also moonlighted as an accountant. He had those two jobs. Now, when you're looking at the kind of fiscal crunch states around the country are going to face, the idea that you could have some kind of solid blue-collar or pink-collar, kind of civil service job, and that's going to be something that's going to facilitate your upward mobility, I'm not so sure how available that's going to be, especially to folks who don't necessarily have tons of education. So what I see is this world in which class conflict is layered on top of the politics of color and ethnicity. And what I also think of, in global perspective, think about Southeast Asia. Think about parts of the world where you have that kind of ethnic difference layered on top of differences of wealth, differences of class. And what you often see are the targeting of privileged minorities. And you also see, a very ugly politics towards the weakest and most vulnerable members of those societies. Do I believe that that's inevitable? Absolutely not. But I do fear that that is a scenario that is a real one, and it's one that I badly want to avoid.
Yeah. I want to get back to your national policy proposals and your actually extraordinarily interesting international policy proposals, but you brought up California and the Bay Area. So just to stay on that for just a couple of minutes, and this is a little bit beyond the book, one thing we could do is get substantially more serious about what it would take to create more upward mobility and reduce inequality. The problem with the Bay Area, arguably, is not that it's too progressive, but in fact that it's far too conservative, that the people in the Bay Area are not willing to allow the physical transformation of their communities to the extent that would allow people to own their own homes, build their wealth, and yes, it would transform our communities. So when I read your book, I was wanting a little bit more of not sort of, fatalism around, well, we can't do it for this large group of people, but rather my perspective is, well, how could we create more upward mobility for lower skill immigrants? We have a lot that we could do here in the Bay Area.
Well, part of the story is this. I do believe if you are going to make those public investments, you have to be sensitive to some of the cultural and political context. When you're looking at the moments in American history where Americans were more keen on making big investments in the future, these were moments where you had voters who had bigger families. Mm-hmm. You had voters for whom their feeling was, we have ownership of the future because the future reflects our posterity in literal terms. It's really, when you think about the UC system built by Clark Kerr, this was the height of the baby boom, right? So the idea is, okay, so we're going to make these investments, we're going to make these sacrifices, we're going to do this, but I literally see the reason why.
Right.
It's literally part of the story of my family. And when you have this different climate in which you have smaller family sizes, you have a lot of folks who, kind of have decided for all sorts of perfectly good reasons, perfectly defensible reasons, but that they do not want to have children necessarily. When you have a somewhat older society, you potentially have a pretty different ethic, right? So I think that that's part of the story, and there's another part of the story too. You talked about the Bay Area, so I'll talk about Sweden. I'm certainly no expert, but Sweden is a really fascinating place because Sweden is a place where you kind of ostensibly had this very pro-immigration, really cosmopolitan ethic that was very dominant into the kind of elite strata of Swedish society, but you also saw something else, which is that in terms of the way that people actually lived, native Swedes would pay a very high premium to not live in immigrant-heavy neighborhoods. So you simultaneously have people in surveys who say, I love diversity. Diversity is awesome. I love openness to immigration. It's amazing. Then when you look subjectively at the specific choices they make, the particular social networks that they build and cultivate over time, what you will see is what I think of as almost a kind of curated diversity, something that I think you see in the United States as well, which is to say you have an experience of diversity that is managed because you live in a community that has stringent zoning regulations, something that you were getting at, I think, where, you know, you can have a sign that says refugees welcome in front of your house in Atherton, California, but, you know, guess what? I mean, refugees are not going to be able to afford to live there unless they're living in your spare bedroom, right? And then, you know, kind of more to the point, you know, just the idea is that your experience of this is not an experience of feeling like things are out of control or unmanaged or what have you. Your experience is, I experience exactly as much diversity as I would like to experience it, and as soon as it exerts some cost, as soon is then, you know, I'm able to retreat from it. I'm able to manage my experience of it. And there are other folks who don't necessarily feel like they have that kind of power over their lives.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. We could not possibly see more eye to eye on this. It drives me absolutely nuts that cities in the Bay Area are considering themselves sanctuary cities, but then literally not building any sanctuaries for people, right? Like, if this is going to be a real thing, you need to make some level of sacrifice in order to get there. But I'm not going to make you any friends by having us talk, you know, negatively about the Bay Area for the next like half an hour. So let's
look. I mean, just to kind of build on that point, though. I guess here's how I feel about this. So I'm one of these people who has like really kind of tiresome views about these things. I really believe that we need zoning reform. We ought to build more housing. I believe all of that stuff. But I also believe that there is this weird feeling I sometimes get, you know, which is this attitude that, okay, well, what do you choose as given? What do you choose as kind of politically immovable, things that are not likely to change? And what do you choose as the things that will change? And I guess I often feel as though a lot of folks are in the kind of camp of, some would say openness, maybe I would say hubris, you know, being somewhat ungenerous. I think of it as, oh yeah, if we do X, Y, and Z, if we did these things, everything would be great. But then X, Y, and Z are things that are deeply unpopular because, yeah, I mean, there is a natural aversion to change that people have, right? So I often, a friend of mine calls these polycebos. You know, so think about a placebo. It's kind of fake. It's not real medicine. So a polycebo is a policy that's not a real policy. You don't actually expect it to really happen. You just use it to get over an argumentative hump. So you say, oh yeah, this is totally going to work as long as we just, you know, kind of basically upzone Atherton, California and make it, you know, kind of full of dwellings for kind of recent working class immigrants who are penniless. Yeah, that's a great idea. But that's something that is, you know, folks are pretty resistant to that for all sorts of reasons. And I'm not sure that that's going to be the thing that's going to change. And I think you actually saw this, and forgive me for talking about, you know, kind of you know, something in the past. But, you know, the Gang of Eight bill was really interesting. The Gang of Eight bill was, and perhaps we'll talk about this more later, was immigration legislation that styled itself as a compromise. And part of that compromise was saying, we are going to take unauthorized immigrants in the United States, we are going to make them registered provisional immigrants, that was going to be their title, and then we're going to say they are barred from safety net benefits. Now, Los Angeles County thought, okay, this legislation might actually pass. And so Los Angeles County was preparing to sue the federal government over it. Why? Because Los Angeles County was home to hundreds of thousands of people who had fallen in this RPI category and thought, wait, what's going to happen? We need these billions of dollars to actually provide these folks with kind of basic care. Now, the thing is that I believe that many of the people who were behind the Gang of Eight bill, they didn't really believe that Los Angeles would be left hanging. They thought, this is a polycebo. It's a fake policy. It's designed for us to pass legislation that is not actually real. We will pretend that that's going to be the case. It's not really going to be the case because it's frankly impracticable. But again, it gets us over an argumentative hump. And when I think about these debates, one reason why I was so exercised and so eager to write this book, and I felt like I've got to get this off my chest, is just the feeling that so much of this debate is fake. You know, it's not people taking a real position. It's not people really bearing the consequences of taking a position that makes them seem open-hearted and enlightened.
Yeah. Just quickly before we get to your grand bargain, because I definitely want to get into that. One of the things I found the most fascinating about your book were The instances where you took your sort of logical perspective to its conclusion. And one of the big areas was that this creates some level of moral obligation and also like advanced self-interest for the United States to invest heavily in other countries.
Yes. So, you know, again, as someone who really takes the arguments of people with whom I disagree on this pretty seriously. I mean, you know, a lot of these are people who are much smarter than I am. You know, these are people who thought really deeply about these issues. I thought to myself, okay, how do I take seriously the fact that there are literally billions of people around the world who are desperate for a better life? Now, again, thinking about, you know, just thinking about the way that so much of this debate seems not real, not authentic, there's really no one in the debate who's saying that, yeah, we ought to open ourselves to literally billions of people. You know, if you look, it's just simply not something that people take seriously. When you're looking at future migration flows, it's really striking. So Latin America is aging. Mexico in particular is aging very rapidly. The places that are going to have really robust growth in their working age population, it's pretty much sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And you know, when you think about that, I mean, there are going to be so many people who want better opportunities. And we're just not going to provide them through the form of migration. There are some people who want to see that. There are some serious people who kind of try to make that argument. I just don't think that's going to happen. So what does that mean? And to my mind, what that means is that we have to think really hard, not just about this kind of symbolic gesture, not just about this kind of feel-good politics, but rather thinking hard about, yeah, what does it make you know, what does it mean to kind of translate the kind of limited resources we have at our disposal into creating decent lives for kind of larger numbers of people? And that, you know, kind of was one chapter of the book where I just tried to throw out a variety of different ideas, you know, as to what that might look like. Ideas that, you know, some of them will likely sound kind of zany, but that I really think are going to sound a lot less zany in 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, I don't want to give away all the good stuff, but this is really a good book. And I loved
Thank you.
One of your zany ideas. And one of the zaniest was the Medicare Tequila Sunrise idea, right? Where you would have sort of encourage people, seniors, to move to Mexico. So spin that out for us a little bit and take their Medicare with them.
There are 1 million people, U.S. citizens, who currently reside in Mexico. They are mostly retirees. And I guess one thing that I find striking, I was chatting about this with a friend of mine. I won't name her because I don't want to out her. But we were talking about how, you know, one problem with the immigration narratives that, you know, we often encounter in our little world is that they seem really fatalistic about the rest of the world. They seem to paint a really dark picture. The idea is that, you know, these other places are such awful, miserable places. We must liberate them. We must save them. Rather than having a kind of opportunity narrative, the idea that actually there are tremendous opportunities in other corners of the world. And when you think about this really big, thorny problem, which is that there are a lot of people who are going to need labor-intensive services, and who are not who are going to have a really hard time affording them in the United States. They're going to have a really hard time affording them in the United States with a $15 minimum wage. Yeah, these are just kind of certain realities. It's going to be really hard to afford them when you say, okay, you pay a low wage, but we're also going to offer folks the earned income tax credit and the refundable portion of the child tax credit and Medicaid and SNAP and a variety of other benefits to ensure that those people lead decent and dignified lives. So when you think about that, just thinking, okay, well, you just think about offshoring. The idea that, you know, in some cases it might make sense to say, if you are in need of low-cost, labor-intensive services, maybe it makes sense to form partnerships with societies that have an abundance of that kind of labor, rather than saying that, okay, we're going to try to kind of reverse engineer this. I really believe that having a deeper partnership with Mexico, having kind of a win-win strategy vis-a-vis Mexico makes a lot more sense. And when you think about the fact that there are 1 million people living there without access to their Medicare benefits, you know, it's really interesting. I do think that this could be a very big opportunity, especially when you consider that in the future, there are going to be a lot of folks, a lot of retirees who themselves have roots in Latin America and who might find that prospect really attractive. So I do think that that's the kind of seemingly zany idea that's going to seem a lot like common sense in the near future.
Yeah, no, that could be interesting.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, Please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
All right, so let's get to your grand bargain. I recommended, he didn't take my recommendation, that for the Bay Area copies of this book, it should say, The Child of Immigrants Makes the Case for Amnesty. Because actually, that's in your bargain. So spell out a little bit for us what this grand policy bargain you envision is and how it would help resolve some of the issues that you set up earlier in the book.
Well, I'll tell you, I started out from thinking about what are the bipartisan grand bargains we've been talking about since the early 2000s. What do they look like? What have been the kind of chief driving concerns? If you look at McCain-Kennedy, if you look at the Gang of Eight legislation, they basically had pretty broadly similar contours. You could say it was a compromise between folks who wanted some kind of large-scale amnesty for the long-settled, unauthorized immigrant population in the United States. Over two-thirds of this population has resided in the United States for, you know, 5+ years. And then, on the other hand, the folks they were making a compromise with were folks who wanted access to low-wage, low-skill guest worker labor. The thesis was, essentially, we're going to make a compromise between the Wall Street Journal editorial page and between advocates on the left, including an organized labor who wants some kind of amnesty. Now, my view is that that actually isn't really the divide in our country right now. If you're talking about that slice of the public, folks on the political right who say that we're fine with immigration as long as immigrants do not have access to the safety net, I just don't really believe that that is a kind of broadly held, especially popular opinion in the country. My reading of public opinion is that people really, really care about an immigration system that is controlled and managed. They really care about an immigration system they feel is in the national interest, that serves the interests of, you know, all American workers. There could be some debate about should the numbers be high or low, but, you know, also when you see more sophisticated survey analysis that is not just doing one poll question but several questions and kind of varying characteristics and what have you, you see what two political scientists, Dan Hopkins and Jens Heimuller, call a hidden immigration consensus. You know, meaning, you know, we want folks who are basically going to be able to support themselves and their families, who are going to be able to kind of engage in mainstream culture, who are going to speak the language, not necessarily with perfect fluency, but be able to speak conversational English. That is the kind of broad mainstream position, but it's not really a position you saw reflected in these grand bargains, in my opinion. So what I tried to think about was, okay, what would a grand bargain look like that actually reflects the kind of center of opinion? And that's what I came up with, a grand bargain that says that, yes, we will have some kind of path to legal status is one term, we will have some kind of amnesty, provided it's coupled with very stringent enforcement and particularly workplace enforcement going forward. But also, we are going to change the way we approach future flows in which we will prioritize those who will be in a position to provide for themselves and their families. And also, we are going to have a component of this, which is saying that we are going to redouble in making public investments in young people. If you're looking at the children of immigrants, they are disproportionately poor. And, not wildly disproportionately, but they are disproportionately poor. And but then there are also a lot of folks who are the children of natives who kind of feel, how am I bought into this? How am I bought into the ways in which the country is changing? How is my posterity at stake, in these debates? And that's why I thought that those three pieces, you have an amnesty, but you rethink future flows to help ensure that the policy is going to be in the broader national interest. And then you have a redoubling of investment in the young.
So you just introduced me to this word, so I'm going to use it. To what extent is that not a policebo, right? I mean, let's pause it for the moment. That's actually the right policy. My concern is that you're sort of alienating the entire Trump wing of the Republican Party by proposing amnesty. You're alienating the country club wing of the Republican Party by proposing that we actually enforce employers' practices. And then you're alienating all of the Democrats by having restricted immigration. So that's part of my concern, is that it seems fantastic, perhaps, but does it have any constituency whatsoever?
Well, when you look at Donald Trump's voters, when you look at Republican voters, when you see opinion among those voters, you actually do see a fair bit of openness to some kind of amnesty, provided it is earned, provided that it is stringently enforced, and provided it's accompanied by a real investment in enforcement. My view is that a lot of voters backed Donald Trump because they felt that he was directionally right in asserting that the immigration system should serve the interests of Americans, and that this should not be an idea that's anathematized. This is an idea that ought to be taken seriously. And you know, when you compare him to, for example, a figure like Jeb Bush, someone who is very admirable in all sorts of ways, but in a funny way, to a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, when they heard his rhetoric about immigration and cultural change, they almost felt as though Jeb Bush is someone who celebrates and praises immigrants, but does not necessarily hold working-class, native-born Americans in especially high regard. Now, you know, that might be wrong, that might be unfair to Jeb Bush, but that was certainly this kind of cultural message that a lot of people heard and received. Whereas Donald Trump, you know, they heard this message, okay, he is willing to say these things that are really outre, that are out there, that are views that I don't necessarily share, but I feel like he's directionally right. Donald Trump has also been pretty inconsistent in how he's talked about these issues, including how he's talked about amnesty. He has actually expressed openness to some kind of amnesty, provided he gets something on the side of future flows. So when I look at opinion in the Republican Party and how it's changed over time, I actually really do see openness to something like the grand bargain I've described, provided people feel as though there is consistent leadership, because frankly, a lot of politicians, Republican or Democratic, feel very insecure in this moment. You have a lot of, let's talk about Democrats for a moment, you have a lot of Democratic politicians who were talking about immigration in one way as recently as 2008, in a way that emphasized the centrality of enforcement and what have you, who now felt, gosh, our constituency has materially changed. The composition of the Democratic and Republican parties is markedly different to what it was 10 years ago. And in that climate, when you're feeling like there's this tremendous change, in that climate where, frankly, you have a kind of Silicon Valley cosmopolitan liberalism you feel is another pole of influence in your political party, you feel really uncertain and cautious about doing something that you fear will get you in political hot water. That's definitely true for Republicans too, albeit from a different direction. About a third of Americans are consistently not quite a third, but close, are consistently opposed to amnesty on rule of law grounds. Now, this is contested, but there are some folks, some scholars who say, what this means is that even if you tell them that, hey, it's someone who has these really attractive, desirable characteristics, they still say, nope, don't want an amnesty because it's categorical. That's a really big thing. And in the discourse around opposition to amnesty, it often sounds as though people who oppose an amnesty are racist, they're bigoted, they're hateful people, rather than, no, they're actually really concerned about the rule of law. And that rhetoric really drives people into their camps. It really makes it hard to have any kind of middle ground. And I think that that's one reason why we've had this barrier to it. But if you had leadership that felt a little more confident, if you had someone like Donald Trump, frankly, say more consistently some of the things he said occasionally, I really do believe that you would see some kind of change. But, again, consistency has not always been a strong suit.
Well, I mean, look, I would take inconsistent. I think that the bigger concern, and it's a concern you articulate in this book repeatedly, is that many of the things that he said are corrosive to our social culture. And so to the extent that we believe that we want to create this culture that people can buy into, that it feels like the right kind of melting pot, he may be in some sort of abstract sense directionally correct for a certain subset of the population, but he's distant in the other direction. How do we get past this, and do we?
I wrote this book really thinking about the year 2032. That sounds totally weird, but it really is true. I'll give you a roundabout explanation for this. So I was looking recently at the numbers of folks who are of Bangladeshi origin born in the United States. This is an overwhelmingly foreign-born population. About 25% of this population consists of folks who were like me, were born in the United States. And if you're looking at those folks who were born in the United States, the number who you know, my age, you know, I'm almost 40 years old, is vanishingly small. It's like, you know, basically about 1% of this already pretty small group. So when I was growing up, I was just in a really different cultural and social world. I was in a world, you know, which I was surrounded by lots of folks who were African-American, Jewish-American, Italian-American, Chinese-American. I was just in this very kind of diverse social world. And I was in a world in which there were some people who looked different from me, you know, who were, you know, nasty and kind of mean-spirited and what have you. And I was around a lot of other people who were incredibly kind to me. Incredibly good to me, incredibly invested in my success. And when I think about people who are 10 or 15 years younger than me, and I think about the cultural politics of our moment, and that's obviously a much kind of, you know, bigger subject, I just kind of feel as though my upbringing, I almost feel this obligation to kind of take something from it and try to be someone who is a bridge builder, someone who is trying to try to transcend some of these really ferocious seeming divides in our culture. And that's not something that feels especially rewarded. When I look at, you know, my industry, my line of work, there's a huge premium on battle, on having fight in you, being a warrior. And I get it, and I think it's exciting. I kind of enjoy seeing it in a way myself. But trying to be honest with myself, you know, I'm just kind of much more someone. It's really important to me to try to speak to these different audiences and try to meet them halfway, partly because I really believe that we're going to need people who are bridge builders. People, you know, kind of, you mentioned that, you know, you're from the more Appalachian slice of Ohio, and here you are in the Bay Area. And, you know, people might look at your face, and they might hear your name, and they might make all kinds of assumptions about who you are, where you're from. You know, same thing with me. But then you have this kind of secret superpower almost, which is that actually I have a lot of other stories. I have a lot of other experiences. And you might kind of assign me to this or that camp, but I actually have that. And that's something that gives me this kind of binocular vision. I can see through two different eyes that gives me kind of depth perception. I mean, that sounds very self-serving, but I think that I'll bet that everyone in this room feels that on a certain level. I'll bet that almost everyone in this room feels like you've been part of more than one world, you played more than one kind of role. And the problem is that in our politics right now, trying to inhabit those different worlds and trying to build bridges feels inauthentic. And it's something that really oftentimes feels like it makes you a target of abuse. So I guess that, you know, for me, I just was thinking, I really care about the future, and I really want to reach people, including younger people, and give them a different narrative, a different story for how to think about these issues, and to not necessarily dismiss people who disagree with them kind of instinctively. That's a big
thing. No, that makes sense. You know, maybe my, you know, perspective on that is it would also feel good to fall asleep and wake up in 2032 and hope that stuff had like dealt with itself by then. Because it is a rough time right now. So let's get to some questions from the audience, and let's do some wonky economics. If you believe in sort of limiting immigration to essentially maintain a wage base, right, to maintain a good quality of life for, you know, recent immigrants and lower skill folks in society, why not just dramatically raise the minimum wage?
Well, this is a really good and useful question. So I guess my view is that a lot of folks who talk about immigration and the economic consequences of immigration are really focused on wages and wage competition. And if you you know, read the book, you'll find that that's actually not chiefly what I emphasize, because actually immigration can also grow the pie. You have a somewhat bigger economy. There are all kinds of other effects. You have complementarities. That is, someone with one set of skills can complement someone with a different set of skills, so you can get economic benefits from that. So I guess the story that I tell is that our immigration policy really shapes the character of our economy, because economies are dynamic, you know, particularly free, dynamic, open economies. These are economies where when you get different, when the price of gasoline, you know, goes up three times, you adapt to that by adopting new and different business models. When you kind of have this thing called the internet, you just kind of create new, you optimize business models around this new technology. I think it's very similar when you think about how you change the labor force. But here's what happens. In a society in which you say, okay, we are not going to sharply increase the size of the low-skill workforce, one thing that happens is that you have to upgrade a lot of jobs that were historically considered low-skill, low-wage jobs. What you do is you augment those jobs with labor augmenting technology. You do a variety of other things. You might have more training. You might have apprenticeship programs. You might say, hey, let's actually have year-round part-time employment for younger people who want to kind of earn an income. You do a variety of things that you don't necessarily have to do because you have this kind of mana from heaven in the form of oftentimes pretty desperate, disciplined workers who kind of quote-unquote, solve that problem for you. If you look at Maine, for example, coastal Maine, these kind of beautiful towns that have always relied on seasonal workers coming from Eastern Europe. Now, when you say, okay, we're going to shut off that supply, it really caused a panic. It was really hard for them, and they had to do something that had previously been unthinkable. They basically started hiring furloughed prisoners. They became more open to hiring ex-offenders. I'm not saying this is kind of one-to-one or it's as simple as that, but I do believe that when you're thinking about drawing on some of our, to sound really clinical, underutilized human resources, I do think that's part of the story. Now, when you're looking at the minimum wage, I guess my view is that when you're thinking about increases in the minimum wage that are sufficiently high that you know, your earned income, your kind of like, oh, you know, your take-home pay over the course of a year, I really think that that would also drive changes in business models. And also it raises consumer prices and what have you. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing in itself, but I think that the consequence would be what you see in many parts of Northern Europe, where you've had high effective minimum wages that have interacted with low-skill migration in a not great way. So when you look at Sweden, for example, here I am mentioning Sweden again, they had this big influx of refugee migration, but then what they found is that refugee migrants in an economy that's built around a high-skill workforce, that's built around upgraded jobs, that has a high effective minimum wage because of collective bargaining, and that's kind of a complicated issue, but basically you have a lot of people who really struggle to get a foothold in the labor market. So you basically have this huge number of people who actually are not active participants in the mainstream economy. And I think that that could be one consequence of that. Now, again, that's contested. Other people will think differently about it, but that's certainly my takeaway.
Yeah, okay. Although, you know, I have to say, there's all this talk about, you know, the future of work and jobs disappearing and automation.
I hear it all the time, right?
Jobs are supposed to have already disappeared. You can find think tank papers from quite a long time ago that suggest that all these various different trends that you mentioned should lead to no jobs. Yet here in California, where we have a very high minimum wage, we're at virtually full employment.
There was a really fascinating conversation about these issues in the 1950s and 1960s. There was really intense anxiety about automation and its likely consequences. And it's really striking because what happened then, you had this different discourse. You had this belief that you know, workers had leverage. And they were able to kind of demand that, you know, their voices would be included and that they will be part of this change. They would be included in those changes. They would have a voice. Now, when you're talking about the California economy, I've got to say, I guess I think about it through a somewhat different lens, because when I think about a workforce, a kind of foreign-born workforce, an immigrant workforce, that, you know, okay, you have a big unauthorized component, then you have folks who are naturalized citizens, but who tend to vote at really low levels. It's not always clear to me that we actually know about, you know, kind of what life looks like for them, what life looks like if you're living in an illegal basement dwelling, what life looks like if you're actually kind of doubled up in an apartment, and also, you know, kind of what do hours look like, and actually, you know, you might be earning a wage, but you're earning a wage in which you really are struggling to live what we consider a decent and dignified life. So, you know, I actually really do believe that if you had 1 billion immigrants move to the United States tomorrow, I really do believe that they would all have jobs. And, you know, what I believe would happen is this. Automation would move in a different direction. Rather than having self-driving cars, middle-income people would have chauffeurs. And the technology we would have would maybe be technology of social control. It would be technology that kind of shields you from the chaos of the favelas that would expand around every American city. It would just be, technology would go in a different direction. So the thing is, it's not like technology does X in this predictable way. Technology actually responds to changes in the labor force. An egalitarian society has different technology, has different business models than a very stratified and inegalitarian society. Technology works in both places, but we make social choices about the character of the economy that we want.
Yeah. An interesting question here. What are the factors that should inform the future flows of immigration? And in particular, Are there circumstances that would lead you to advocate for significantly more immigration? I'll add to this, I found your argument that because domestic birth rates are going down, we should have less immigration, to on a certain level be counterintuitive. And maybe this is a little bit beyond the context of your book. Even on a national security level, do we actually want fewer people here in the United States while these other countries are growing much more quickly?
Well, this is not quite. So in the book, again, what I say is that, you know, I'm, you know, kind of as part of this kind of grand bargain, I'm fine with keeping the number of green cards that we issue annually at roughly where it is right now. I believe that there is a case for reduction, but that's not the case that I make. The case that I make is for rebalancing. So the argument that you're referencing is this idea that actually birth rates have a pretty big and profound effect on the politics of immigration. So we're, if you look at the past, immigration, the children of immigrants, you know, has represented a pretty big chunk of population growth. If you're looking between now and 2060, it's going to represent over 90% of all population growth in the United States. So when you're thinking about the future workforce, its composition, its skills, immigration policy is a really, really important part of the story. So I guess that's why I think that, you know, kind of thinking about future flows is basically human capital policy. We talk about making investments in K-12 education, higher education, vocational education. Immigration policy is actually a pretty big part of human capital policy, too. Now, in terms of this kind of argument from numbers, you know, I guess I just don't believe that raw numbers in themselves are actually going to be kind of definitive when we're talking about kind of grand strategy and kind of questions of power politics. I really do believe that, legitimacy is a big part of it. If you have a society that is defined by a kind of ferociously divided politics, a society that is defined by enormous amounts of kind of intense ethnic and class conflict, that's not going to be so hot for that society's power, right? And also, when you look at, you know, different societies, you know, one thing you see is that, and Michael Beckley does this in his new book, it's called Unrivaled. It's kind of a book about kind of future questions of kind of great power competition and what have you. What he says is that one really handy rule of thumb is to take the population and then multiply it by the GDP per capita to kind of yield a power index.
Sure.
Merely increasing the size of our population and having this kind of group of people who feels really excluded, I actually could leave you in a much worse place in geopolitical terms. But, you know, that's a kind of longer conversation, which I'm happy to have.
Yeah, it could. Let's do one more beat on it. So, leaving aside China's international immigration policies, they've had a tremendous amount of domestic migration.
Yes.
From the country to the sort of coastal metropolises, and they've largely been able to do that in a way that has dramatically increased the size of their economy and arguably improved the standard of living of the average person in China. Is that a lesson to emulate?
This is something that I find really fascinating. So, you know, kind of as those of you in the audience who follow China know, and as Micah knows too, you know, you also have the hukou system, you have enormous amount of conflict around domestic migration in China. And also, you know, from this is kind of a little bit of a side topic, but if you look at the period from 1979 to 1989, that was a period of very rapid economic growth in China that looked very different from the growth you saw from 89 to the present. That was indigenous entrepreneurial growth that was very balanced regionally. And one thing you could argue, what Yasheng Huang argues, is that in 89, there was this desire to impose more rigid political control. And that's part of why you actually saw a less balanced growth model that was less based on increasing household consumption and what have you. But anyway, I do think that basically making the United States more open to flows of domestic migration, lowering some of those barriers to domestic mobility, would be incredibly powerful. There are a lot of people who would benefit in our country from being able to move to higher opportunity regions, and I believe that that is a real complement to some of the kind of larger arguments I make in this book.
Fair enough. So there's a question around wanting you to say more about how do we encourage this melting pot or assimilation, positive view of immigration through civic education in a world, especially in the Bay Area, where we're moving away from the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, there's all the conflict over the national anthem and so on. People should be able to protest it if they want, but ideally they wouldn't want to. Ideally they would feel very good about it, but we seem to have moved away from that.
What I The way that I've tried to think about this is that when you look historically at these moments when we've had more cohesion and solidarity in American society, it's often happened because of a sense of external threat. It sometimes happened because of coercion. If you look at the First World War, you know, this period when there was an effort to stamp out German language instruction and what have you. When you look at mid-century America, the heyday of the melting pot, you know, kind of there were a lot of folks who felt, okay, you know, I'd better change my last name in order to feel more included. So, you know, there are aspects of that that I think to our ears in 2018 sound pretty unpleasant. But I guess my hope is that by turning down the temperature somewhat, by saying that we want the kind of political economy to work a lot better for working class folks, whether they're working class folks who are native born or of color, or if they're of recent immigrant origin, and that that in itself will over time facilitate intermingling and integration. One thing you see is that when you have very high levels of replenishment, that tends to reinforce enclaves. That tends to actually be something of a barrier to that intermingling and intermarriage and what have you. But now we actually have an opportunity because you do see some slowdown in the replenishment of some kind of big recent immigrant origin communities. And that means that actually I think this is actually kind of the perfect time to think about what do we want to do in the next 50, 60 years. So, you know, that doesn't always come across in our politics right now, but I do believe that this is an opportunity we can seize, an opportunity we can take advantage of to recreate that melting pot ethic from the bottom up. And when I say from the bottom up, I mean creating more integrated communities in which people have more face-to-face interactions. People don't only see one another through a kind of ethnic lens. I do believe that there's hope.
All right. Well, let me sort of start to wrap things up with a fairly simple question from the audience. So we may not actually have a choice about these things. Many predictions in terms of climate change suggest that we may have as many as billions of refugees from now uninhabitable parts of the world that we may have to make room for here in the United States. How would or would that sort of change your perspective on what we ought to be doing?
Well, this is a possibility. There's really no gainsaying. That is a world that would potentially be so chaotic and so utterly different from our own. That's a world in which many state structures would likely prove very fragile and that might kind of buckle under the weight. I personally don't think that scenario is not my modal scenario for what the future is going to look like. But I think that if that were to happen, there would be so many things, quite frankly, that would have to change about our society, the way that it looks, the way that it works, that, you know, kind of, I question, you know, the idea that that's kind of like the right way to kind of think about policy right now. But I'll also say something that is going to sound kind of dark and difficult, which is this. The United States is an island. We are in the Americas. If you look at the Americas, you see this rapid aging of populations in Latin America that I've described. Mexico is actually aging more rapidly than the United States. And when you're looking at the parts of the world that are likely to be most grievously affected by climate crises and what have you, assuming that that does indeed unfold, that does indeed come to pass, are places that are far away enough from the United States that you will not be able to arrive in the United States on a rickety boat. You would come via a visa. You would fly to the United States. And, you know, look, I mean, I think that that is something that is fundamentally going to be more optional for us. In the era of, you know, from the 70s to, let's say, the late 90s, that was an era when you had this massive demographic surge and you had this kind of like big, kind of like large amount of unauthorized immigration for that reason. Right now, Europe is going through this different experience because, you know, kind of as Gordon Hansen has said, the Mediterranean has become the new Rio Grande. That's where you have these intense population pressures. So I guess my view is that Europe is going to be way more vulnerable to this, and that's why I argue in the book, you know, kind of at some length, that's why we need to partner with them to do the right thing, to do the humane thing. But frankly, I think that that is going to be very optional. This notion that we will have to accept large numbers of climate migrants, I think that that's going to be more a choice than something that we have no control over.
Well, and maybe this gets back to the initial point that you're making, which is to say, if you are someone like myself who genuinely thinks that you know, we shouldn't try to be an island in this world. You better start planning for a billion additional people to live in the United States, right? You can't carefully parse, well, you know, I'm a very moral person, but, you know, we're going to exclude these billions of climate migrants. And so, you know, you're ultimately saying that you need to have the courage of your convictions and prepare for substantial immigration rather than sort of parsing immigration policy and claiming the moral high ground.
I believe that a society, the changes we would have to make such inflows sustainable, I believe would really jeopardize much of what I consider good and valuable about this society. I believe that you would have to tolerate drastically higher levels of domestic inequality, you know, kind of drastically higher levels that I think would be corrosive of some of our shared civic ideals. You know, this is a contentious question. Others will disagree, but I guess that's how I see it. So that's, but I do think that, yeah, I mean, if people have the courage of their convictions on this question, more power to them. I really do appreciate and respect it.
Yeah. And ultimately, I mean, your argument is a fundamentally conservative argument, which is to say, which I think a lot of people in the Bay Area misunderstand what the heart of conservatism is, which is if we want to take really seriously improving the livelihoods of a certain set of people, we need to go about it carefully. And I think is that really the heart of your book?
One of the ideas that really stuck with me throughout the writing of this book, it's not something that I wrote about explicitly, but you know, it was more present in earlier drafts, was that old Edmund Burke line about how society is a compact between the living, the dead, and the unborn. I think of this as really the core conservative insight. And that's why in this book, I really say, look, what happens when you think about immigration in multi-generational terms rather than in terms of our immediate emotive reaction to these issues? So yes, I do think that's an idea that I tried to take very seriously.
Well, Burke is always a good note to end on. So our thanks to Raihan Salam, executive editor of the National Review and author of the new book, Melting Pot or Civil War, for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Micah.
Just a quick reminder to the audience. I don't have a gavel. I've seen people with gavels before, but I'll just do a virtual gavel. I'm Micah Weinberg, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thank you very much, Micah. Thanks. I really appreciate it.